First of all, start by adjusting your motivation, thinking that you're here in this occasion to listen to the most profound and extensive teachings of the Mahayana. The reason why you do that is because you aspire to be able to benefit sentient beings who are as vast as the vastness of space. So for their sake, you aspire to reach this precious state of perfect and complete enlightenment, the state that is characterized by the full development of all positive qualities and the total elimination of all negativity. With this particular thought in your mind, please adjust your motivation.
Then as the song is a drubala, some of the jita of the present. Number new, song of person, each and the chipper and papa, you know she. Nama deva, Tabrakan, the Travosi Marasonga, Nanja. Or do that song you jumped in the Tinuji, some genji tondo, no tombo two jiba, they are some genji tondo two ji. Where the Sunamdan Shijin Songi, do Kerjan Dome, some jiran, and so sabat, they are some genji tondo songi so. ထာရမဘရဇဘရဆောင်းကြီးပါတေယောဆင်ခြင်းကြီးတုံးတဲ့ဆောင်းကြီးဟောကြည့်တဲ့ဒီနေ့ဆောင်းကြီးကိုဓမ္မကြီးတေလာကြီးချူဆောင်ရချင်ကုကုပါတေယောဆင်ခြင်းကြီးတုံးတဲ့ဆောင်းဒါတင်တဲ့ကကြီးချူကြီးဆွတ်စေကြီးတေလာကြီးဆင်ခြင်းစေကြီးဒီမူဝမန္တရပါခမန္တရပါဟောဘောရမ်တဲ့နံပါတ်နာဆောင်မဟောဘူးကြီးရွာရင်သူစွတ်စွတ်ဆွင်ခမ်းတောင်တက်နေကြီးဒီဝါလာဂဝါလာကြီးချူကြီးဆွတ်တိဒီဝါကြီးဆောင်း
Urshi started today by quoting the great Lama Tsongkhapa, who is talking about the activities of the Buddha, and basically says that everything that the Buddha has ever done was always done for the sake of sentient beings. In the beginning, when he generated the mind of enlightened, it was for the sake of sentient beings. The extensive accumulation of merit and primordial awareness that lasted over three countless eons, again, was carried out for the benefit of sentient beings. The act of manifesting enlightenment was also done for the sake of sentient beings. And after having achieved this state of enlightenment, the act of engaging in teachings, of course, it was done for the sake of sentient beings. And when we talk about teaching sentient beings, it is important to understand that they have a great variety, they have great differences in their aspirations, in their interest, in their intelligence. Some have supreme intelligence, have some middling intelligence, have some low intelligence, and all of them have different interests. For those who have interest in experiencing bliss and happiness and bliss and joy and so forth, particular teachings were given to them. For those who did not have interest in this particular area, other teachings were given. Now, when we talk about the different teachings that are given by the Buddha, we can group them into teachings of the lesser vehicle and teachings of the great vehicle. And again, within the great vehicle, we can make the distinction between the teachings of the perfection vehicle, which are sutric teachings, and the teachings of the mantric vehicle. And although we can never judge and make the distinction and say that, let's say, mantra is better than sutra or sutra is better than mantra, nevertheless, there are different teachings that are given to beings who have different needs. Then there is a distinction from the point of view of the trainees. It is said that the mantric teachings were given to trainees with supreme capacities. So it's not that mantra is said is better than sutra. It is from the point of view of the people who practice it that we can make a distinction of sharpness or less sharpness. Now, although we have already stated that the mantric teachings were given to trainees of supreme capacities, we need to understand that even within this group, there were differences in the power of the capacity of practice amongst different trainees. Of course, we say that they were all very intelligent, they were all very, very sharp, they were all capable of penetrating and going deep into the meaning of their practices. They have the capacity to practice with determination and strength. Nevertheless, there were differences even within the group of those supreme and intelligent trainees. And this is why we end up with having four classes of tantra. The action tantra was given to those who were the least capable from within this group. Performance tantra was given to be as a means of practice for those who had slightly better capacity. Yoga tantra was given to those who were above those. And finally, the highest yoga tantra was a particular set of teachings, you can say, for the elite, for the supreme of the supreme, of those of the intelligent ones. Now, if we look at those four classes of tantra, we can actually understand quite a bit from the etymology of their names. So just by hearing the names action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga tantra, you should be able to derive some meaning from that. When we look at Action Tantra, the name itself indicates that the practitioners on that level are very much interested in a certain type of activities. And from among internal and external activities, they're really quite interested in carrying out external activities, activities such as cleansingness, cleaning, bathing, and so forth. And it is due to this reason that this group of teachings were given the name Action Tantra. When we come to the second class, which is Performance Tantra, Performance Tantra was given to those trainees who seemed to place equal emphasis on external and internal activities. So they had this balance. They thought they are both equally important. So they are performing both external and internal activities. So we have looked at the etymology of action and performance tantra. Now we can look into yoga tantra. Now, it is said that practitioners of yoga tantra are actually much more interested in performing internal activities, the internal yogas. So from among the external and the internal, they would always have a preference and a tendency to apply themselves to internal yogas. And this is how the name Yoga Tantra has been applied. Now we come to the last class of tantra, which is called the highest, the supreme. There is none above this one. And the reason why this name has been given is because trainees that have interest for this particular class of tantra, they're actually supreme. If you compare them with the previous three classes, they are superior, they are above that. And actually they do not need to rely on the type of activities and the limitations, let's say, that trainees of the three lower tantras seem to adhere to hold so important. Now, we talked about Action Tantra, and we say that the trainees that are suitable to practice this, they place a lot of emphasis in external activities, and in particular activities of cleansingness. And this will explain why there are so many cleaning rituals that are included in their practices, and also the reason why they abstain from taking meat. It's not just that they say that taking meat is, let's say, a negative action, it's just that they consider meat to be unclean. And since cleansingness is so important for them, they avoid taking meat. Also, when they engage in their practices of approximation and so forth, they would avoid any type of food that can produce a bad smell. So anything like garlic or onion or radish, the white radish. These are foods to be avoided during the time of their practice. And you can see that their practices are actually they have quite a lot of common with some of the Hindu sadhus in India who would practice in a way where they would only take vegetarian food, they would avoid meat, they would avoid substances such as onion and garlic and anything that can be seen as unclean or to produce some unclean smells and so forth. So it's all because there is emphasis on external activity and rituals of purification. Now, we have to understand also some a statement of the Buddha that was given in particular occasion, and we have to see it always within the context that it was given. So, for example, in the case of the sutra of the descent in the Lankavatara Sutra, the descent in Lanka, which is Sri Lanka, there is statement in that where the Buddha says, for those who will take meat, I will not consider them anymore to be my followers, to be my students. Nevertheless, this statement was given within a particular context, because at that time, at the land of Sri Lanka, there was a widespread practice of eating humans and taking the flesh of the humans. So this particular practice, of course, was seen as being a wrong one, and the Buddha was trying to subdue beings who were consuming human flesh. So he gave the advice to them that they should totally abandon taking meat, and that those who would continue taking meat would not be considered his followers anymore. Now, although this statement was done in this particular occasion, and it is clearly recorded in the Lankavatara Sutra, we need to understand that this was given only for the purpose of subduing these particular trainees. Because, for example, in the highest yoga tantra, we have the practice of partaking of the five meats and the five ambrosias. So it's not a blanket statement that is to be applied in all cases and occasions. Now there was another statement that was done regarding how to partake meat, and the Buddha has said that for the ordained people it is not suitable to take meat that have any of the three impurities, but meat which is not contaminated by the three impurities can be taken, can be consumed. Now, what are these three impurities? So, for example, if you see with your own eyes that an animal is slaughtered in order to prepare your own meal, that would be the first impurity. The second impurity would be not to directly see it with your eyes, but to hear that somebody slaughtered an animal to provide food for yourself. And the third impurity would be not to see directly, not to hear it, but even to suspect that someone went out of the way to take the life of an animal in order to provide food. If it is not any of these three cases, then it is considered to be meat which is not polluted by the three impurities. So, for example, if you were to go into a restaurant where usually meat is provided, meat dishes are provided, they're not prepared in particularly for you, you just happen to walk in and be one of the customers. So if it is a case like this, you can partake meat because it's not polluted by these three impurities. Also, in some sutras, we can find particular mantras that are there to be recited in order to bless the meat when it is taken. And this blessing is actually sort of prayers that we're doing for the animal that had been killed. And all these mantras are there to ensure that this animal will attain a better rebirth next time. So you can see that this advice regarding meat changes. Now, in some countries it is said that it is not good to partake meat. In other countries it was a right to partake meat. In some occasions where there was need, it was appropriate to take meat. In some cases where it was, you know, where one has to check whether there is pollution, contamination from the three pollutants and so forth, it might become inappropriate to take it. So you can see this in general, we cannot say that in Buddhism it is prohibited to take meat. There, such a statement that covers all cases and occasions has not been made.
Now,
Having talked a little bit about the etymology and the names of the four classes of Tantra, we can go back into our text. Yesterday we stopped at the point where we were discussing performance Tantra. We have finished already the explanation of action Tantra. Within performance Tantra, we have covered the first and second parts, which is the type of initiation one receives and the vows and commitments to be maintained. And we're on the third part, which is the way to approximate the deity, the way to meditate on the path. Within that, we saw that there are two types of meditation, yoga with signs and yoga without signs. We have talked about yoga with signs yesterday when we explained how one meditates on the form of the deity that has been generated. And now we move into the second one, which is yoga without signs. We're on page 6. Second or third paragraph from the bottom. So number two is yoga without signs. When one attains calm abiding, focusing on the body of the deity, etc., one meditates on emptiness by combining it with deity yoga. One achieves the union of calm abiding and insight, comprehending emptiness through combining analysis and placement. So Umsha was saying that actually the advice that we have here is pretty similar to the statements that we have already come across in the context of action Tantra. First of all, one generates the form, the body of the deity. And once one develops calm abiding by focusing on the particulars of that form. And following that, it is important that one starts developing special insight, focusing on the emptiness of inherent existence of that deity that has been established. So after one has reached fully qualified calm abiding and is capable of holding the focal object with stability and clarity single-pointedly, one moves into the second stage, which is yoga without signs, where one contemplates the emptiness of inherent existence. And as we have said before, it is very important to alternate between placement and analytical meditation, because too much of one can harm the other. So you can see it's very clearly stated here. One achieves the union of calm abiding and special insight through combining this analysis and placement. And this word combining means alternating. Now, since we have introduced briefly this, the etymology and as well as some of the meaning of yoga with signs and yoga without signs, the author now continues by stating the tantric stages and to give us further information on these two practices. So it says, concerning the meaning of yoga with and without signs, the tantric stages states, yoga with signs is deity meditation and repetition without meditation on emptiness. Yoga without signs is deity meditation and repetition with meditation on emptiness, but it is not meditation on emptiness alone. So we say it's very clearly again stated, if you're practicing yoga with signs, you're not really meditating on emptiness, you're focusing on doing this, the focal object is the form of the deity, and as you're focusing with that, you will also be doing the repetition of the mantra. When it comes into the second type of yoga, which is the yoga without signs, we have a number of practices that are combined. It says it is deity meditation and repetition with meditation of emptiness, which means that although mainly your focus is meditation on emptiness, it doesn't mean that the form of the deity does not appear. At times your focal object will be the form of the deity. You will also be doing recitation of the mantra, and of course you will be keeping this recollection of emptiness. And the reason, again, that point is stressed in the following statement, where it says it is not meditation on emptiness alone. Because if yoga without signs was meditation on emptiness alone, it would mean that the two, which are method and wisdom, would have to be separated. But at all times, our meditation on emptiness or our practices definitely have to be influenced by them and qualified by the mind of bodhicitta, for example. Method has to be combined with wisdom. And if you continuously, you have to alternate, as I say, you have to combine these different aspects of focusing on the body of the deity as well as contemplating the emptiness of this particular form. It would not be appropriate just to simply concentrate single-pointedly on the form of the deity, because that would not allow you to develop your wisdom, your analytical wisdom that contemplates emptiness, but also would not be appropriate only to focus on emptiness. So you can see the point is stressed here very clearly. Do not separate method with wisdom. On this point, of course, there is a number of debates and a number of points to be investigated. So we start with a debate where it says, one scholar says that deity yoga that is not qualified and yoga that is qualified by the discernment comprehending emptiness is respectively the meaning of yoga with and yoga without signs. Right? So they more or less they give their own definition of what yoga with and yoga without signs is. And it says it all relies on being qualified or not by understanding emptiness. And the author replies to that, that should be examined because there is yoga with the reply to that was that should be examined because there is yoga with signs that is qualified by the discernment comprehending emptiness because it is said that if one meditates on emptiness prior to yoga with signs and at that time one has a strong discernment comprehending emptiness, the yoga with signs that follows after that will be qualified by it. And that is because it is similar to what is stated in the condensed stages of the path. So now on Pelden is not just making up an answer. He is quoting Lama Tsongkhapa in here. So what it says here that in Lama Tsongkhapa's text is that if one has a strong wisdom comprehending emptiness, when one is practicing generosity, prostration, circumambulation, etc., although the mind that is focused in these activities does not comprehend emptiness, it is not contradictory that it engages in the activities through the strength of that. Right? So although it does not directly does it, it can be influenced through the strength of that. And then it says, similarly, if one generates strong bodhicitta at the beginning of the session, and later on one engages in concentration on emptiness, at that time, although bodhicitta is not manifest, it is not contradictory that concentration on emptiness is qualified by its presence. So in other words, what they're saying is that if at the beginning of the session you generate either the mind of bodhicitta very strongly or an understanding of emptiness very strongly, whatever other practices you would do during the main part of the session will be influenced by this mind that was generated at the beginning of the session. And therefore we can have this influence, this support of method and wisdom.
ये नी जगत ओदा दिनदा को शिवचा सोने की नंबर नो थावदा तीसी रंग सम चुजी दे कोना ने रंगे में बाला मु शेरा नी शिवा ची को मो यरमे बा तु ची दन तब तपी यरमे दे शा गु दी सी दा ओदा मोरम चेम नो डोन दे दिनदा सो जंग
नाउ Having given that, there is some further explanation because we need to make the distinction between what is the presentation in sutra and what is the presentation in tantra regarding how we mix or how we combine method and wisdom. So we are on the last paragraph on page 7. So it says, thus, yoga without science in this context is profound and clear non-dual yoga. It is not merely deity yoga qualified by discernment comprehending emptiness, because without meditation on emptiness, it does not become concentration without science. And then we continue again by quoting the general presentation of the classes of Tantra, which states that although they have consummated their absorption with science, they do not have the direct antidote that severs the root of samsara. Therefore, to sever the root of samsara, yoga without science is needed. To meditate on that, one must meditate according to instructions through becoming expert in analytical and placement meditation on emptiness that does not meditate on any relative aspect such as the body of the deity, etc. One minute. I've lost. No, I'm reaching the loss to the wrong thing. I'm sorry, I have jumped page. Yeah, I jumped paragraph. Yeah, sorry, we're in the middle of page 7. Although this is the way that method and wisdom are united in the sutric system, so it says, although this is what we say in the sutra, uniting method and wisdom is not achieved by that alone in the mantric system. So there's something more in mantra and tantra. That is because both the extensive method of deity yoga and the profound wisdom comprehending the lack of inherent existence are inseparably united as the collection of method and wisdom at one time and in one awareness. So it's different from just being qualified by what you have done at the beginning of the session. And the tantric stages states that at the time of the result, both the deity adorned with the marks and signs and the mind of non-observation, reliant on that, abide indifferentially in nature at the same time. So we say that the resultant state that one will achieve will be a state where the two levels of truth, the ultimate and the relative, would be united, would abide together. And if this is your focal object, this is what you wish to achieve, also you would have to try to unite these two aspects already from the time of the path. So it says, similarly, it is necessary that both the method, which is one's body appearing as the Tathagata's body, and the wisdom, focusing on the non-inherent existence of the suchness of one's mind at that time, are indifferentiably united as the collection of method and wisdom at one time in one indifferentiable nature of one awareness. So it's very clearly one awareness, which Rumshi said is almost like having a mirror, and you can have two faces of the mirror. In one of them, you would have the appearing aspect, which is the body of the deity, and on the other side, what you have is the ascertaining aspect, the mind that comprehends the emptiness of that particular appearance, right? So you have these two sides in that mirror appearing at the same time, in the same awareness, in an indifferentiable nature.
我记得今天也没人对待我们全部让让几个点点的然后什么样人家古地西的从那么他一南边的农户然后就没到几千的地牛家几万他一南就几三的我我几个人样他比他地的脚板呢老板他地的都不都板他地板他你几万个人地也是呢我在西藏一些人是我在农村我是你外人都 就他几年呢？当前了几年呢？这就这个角度呢，从他这边你有啊的，等这个过年，他把这几天他的样子，喜欢的几个我都过过的，现在的，我到地上有啊的吧，本来就。
Now, we continue with the further quotation on that, where it says, and although that wisdom comprehending the lack of inherent existence of the appearance of the deity, the aspect held, is one in nature with a mind of extensive deity yoga, positing them as distinct method and wisdom is by the power of convention of distinct isolates, which negates wrong modes of distinction. So what the passage says here is that at times we just need to use to differentiate things. So at times we talk about method and we talk about wisdom, we use different terms for them because we just need to differentiate them. But as a matter of fact, within the context of practice of Tantra, those two things are united within one single awareness. Right? You have the appearing aspect and you have the ascertaining aspect. Now, for those of you who have studied Lauric mind and awareness, you would have come across a type of mind which is in Tibetan called Nangla Manyen, and it means that although something appears to the mind, is not necessarily ascertained, right? And the typical example that is given with that is, let's say that you are in a very busy place where there are a lot of people and there are a lot of things happening simultaneously, right? So you will be hearing sounds, you will be seeing all sorts of things. And let's say that amongst the crowd there is someone that you know, a friend that you know. But because there is so much activity, although you might, you know, the form of that body might appear to your ears, your mind might not necessarily hold the image, might not necessarily lock into that and recognize the person. So it could be the case that something appears but it's not ascertained. Or later on you might have the doubt, did I see my friend in this occasion? Was the person there or not? There's a little bit of doubt arising because although something has been perceived, it has not been ascertained. So this is an example of things, you know, appearing in consciousness, but another part of the mind not necessarily holding into them. What we say in this occasion in the practice of Tantra is that you have one appearing aspect and also you have the ascertaining factor of the mind holding that, understanding the emptiness of that.
Hori dati na jigida, dati ni yonji di domdawu jamni da shisongi chiru, dina asi kamdi tsemi ji nanjuru na dindrawa sabsar nimi ji nanjuru yinji. Tanyo tabo lu samba layi nanjuru sam mandi is. Tanyo gomba dan trarna tsemi ji dingan zonda manjirvi shirdi is inida. Oji dati javlanga konti la, nante la kribirambu ji mar jidi chanam nantana da, jidi chanam li is. Samadan Namba Koyon Magumba Tomba Niji Shi Gumda Jagumla Kiwarashini Mengojanda Gumoshi Dan Sinida. That one Dabaji Sejiga Namjuka Kavni or Ji Kunzoba Nabatas or Yirti Shikushi Kuji Kum Genji. ဒီကြောင်ကြောင်လံကိုမှခရဝတိကိတံကတောင်းညတိဂုံကိုဝရေရောလိကိတံကတောင်းညတိဂုံနာယောတေကြောင်ကြောင်လာယောကိုမှခရဝအညီကမရာကြီးရှေကုမညီကဇုံဇုံလာယောနသိကြည့်တဲ့အနိတင်ဇုံဇုံလာယောတွန်ပညရတ္တအကြတိတေကြည့်နကွန်ပြီးတောင်းဝရနနမရှိနာဒီစေကြည့်တဲ့နိကြေယောနိဒီငောင်းနိရှေယောထံကြီးရင်းကြောင်မေပါကြီးယောကိုရေစနေတဲ့ဆောင်ယောကိုယူတင်
Now we come to a statement that is actually concluding and condensing whatever has come prior to that. So it says, thus, the yoga without science in this context is profound and clear non-dual yoga. It is not merely deity yoga qualified by discernment comprehending emptiness, because without meditation on emptiness, it does not become concentration without science. So it's not merely that at some period of time, maybe you spend some time meditating on emptiness, you actually have to do a proper meditation on emptiness, because, and here the author is quoting the general presentation of the class of Tantra by Khedru Rinpoche, where he says, Khedru Rinpoche says, although they have consummated their absorption with science, they do not have the direct antidote that severs the root of samsara. So merely by meditating on the form of the deity, merely by having developed this calm abiding, this incredible stability of the mind on the form of the deity, you have achieved a lot, but you have not cut through the root of cyclic existence, the root of suffering. Therefore, to sever the root of samsara, yoga without science is needed. To meditate on that, one must meditate according to instruction, through becoming expert in analytical and placement meditation on emptiness that does not meditate on any relative aspects such as the body of the deity. And yoga without science familiarizes with the continuity of the determining awareness, determining the emptiness of inherent existence of all dharmas through logic such as neither being one or many, etc. So what we were saying before is that it is, in order to sever the root of cyclic existence, it is important to do this meditation on emptiness. And it says it is very important to do this to alternate between the analytical and the placement meditation. So at times you place your mind on the form of the deity, you remain with that, you remain with the focal object, and then you alternate, you start doing this investigation on the nature of the lack of inherent existence of those forms that are appear, and through that you do this further development of the practice of the second stage, which is yoga without science. And it is really that one has to develop this familiarity with these two types of meditation and the alternation between them. And through that one can determine also the appearing aspect as well as the emptiness of inherent existence of such appearances.
Tombanya don't chit the tobayana, Tombanya la no gumi, Tombanya got on you the ペナジンガジジンガランジンジテビトンガセナガヨンロイルテシャルゴンギノゴンギテゴグレディテグアディコンガワナユアリセナジソンガビジェツワシレブクトゥキチェンサシトゥキチェンセジェダンオダデニラムムトソナマラソンユアリセオダテリジェンブシチマンブジユアリディジグトンニマジディデニジナフィクウィトゥアリシュアルシャワシタンディ
Now, this statement on the second paragraph of page 8, where it says, Yoga without signs familiarizes with the continuity of the determining awareness, determining the emptiness of inherent existence of all dharmas through logic, such as neither being one or many, etc., is a statement that shows us that we have to employ different types of reasoning in order to induce this understanding of emptiness. We have to understand the emptiness of inherent existence of all dharmas, and we do that through logical examination. Now, following that, there is a debate. So regarding that point, one says, take a subject, that yoga without signs. It follows that it is not deity yoga because the body of the deity with the aspects of face, arms, etc. does not appear. That is because it is a mind directly comprehending emptiness. So what the debate says here is that if you have a mind that directly comprehends emptiness, only emptiness appears into that mind. Therefore, no relative aspects such as the face and the arms and the body of the deity would appear. And if you don't have such appearances, how could you call that a deity yoga? So this is the question that is raised. And Ngawon Pelden, the author, replies to that. There is no privation, because we must accept that the empty basis as subject appears to the conceptual logical awareness comprehending emptiness. And so what is discussed here is, whether emptiness is perceptually comprehended or whether it is comprehended through the use of the generic image. And if you see here the word conceptual logical awareness comprehending emptiness, because it says conceptual, it indicates that emptiness is not perceptually perceived, but rather it is perceived through the generic image. So previously the debate was because it's perceptually comprehended, and here he says it's not perceptually, it's through the generic image, right? And the reason for that is because this has been stated in a number of texts. So it says, because the great commentary of the Madhyamika Kakarika, as well as the stages of the path, Lama Tsongkhapa, has stated, states just that.